proud to present Aaron Batista. I'm proud for two reasons. One is that I'm proud of the Robotics Institute and to bring him in, and I'm also proud of our department over at Pitt. So I was hearing where we just hired him, and he's going to be here full-time in April, but he's here today because we have a bunch of graduate students, some of whom are here, we're trying to recruit to our program. And by the way, for those of you who are in that group, there's going to be a van that goes to Dave and Buster's right after the lecture, right upstairs in front of the building. So that's how you're going to get to your next event. Aaron is an incredible guy. You're going to see what he does. But his background includes a bachelor's in philosophy, in which he switched over to computer science at the University of Pennsylvania, and got a master's there also. Then he got a PhD from Caltech in their computation and neural systems program. And then he moved to Stanford, where he did two postdocs, one with Bill Newsom in studying the visual motor integration in the frontal cortex, and then with Krishna Shenoy doing stuff that he's going to tell you about today. And he's also the husband of a national champion on the West Coast swing dancing circuit. Isn't here, but will be here in April also. So yeah. She'll be here for the next talk.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, George. Thank you guys all for coming today, and thank you to the Institute for inviting me. This is really a great audience, and in my mind, the ideal audience. You know, it's, you can always talk to a bunch of physiologists or a bunch of neuroscientists, and that's one thing, but it's great to talk to people who think about very similar issues from a very different perspective. So I'm hoping that at the end of this talk, or you know, once I'm officially here full-time in April, there'll be a lot of great rapport between us, and you guys will absorb these ideas and tell me what we're doing wrong, tell us a better way to do things, and let's really try to get some good collaborations going across Forbes Avenue. So I want you to think back to your lunch today, all right? And think about, try to remember what you were thinking about while you were eating. Now, don't shout it out. I don't really want to know. But I definitely know I don't want to know for some of you. But I guarantee that you weren't thinking about how to get your food into your mouth. If anything, you were saying, gee, I guess I'm hungry. I'll take another bite of that sandwich. But you weren't saying, got to move my hand forward, down, shape my hand, grasp it, bring it to my mouth, try to avoid missing, spilling it on my shirt, and get it in your mouth. You just make these movements accurately and swiftly at a very subconscious level. You're not planning the details of your movement. But that's not to say that this is an easy problem. In fact, probably why the brain doesn't let you do it is because it's too complicated for slow beings like us to try to do it. This happens automatically. You do it all the time. Our sensory motor actions are seamlessly integrated with our environment, and that's exactly the kind of process that I want to try to understand. I got into this initially because it's just a very compelling question from a biological and a neurobiological vantage point, but in the last few years, advances that this field has made over the last 30 years have translated into real clinical applications in human beings. And I'm actually going to start the talk by showing you someone else's work that has really brought neural engineering into a viable possibility for the future. So this is the work of John Donahue at Brown University. It was published in Nature. It made the cover last year. This is a young man who's had an injury to his spinal cord that's left him quadriplegic. He's unable to move below his neck. He can move his neck around, but he can't move below that. Andy can speak. What you can barely make out there is a port that connects to an array of 100 electrodes that's been embedded in his cortex. And this fellow, Abe Kaplan, is about to hook up a bank of amplifiers and filters that's going to go into some computers that are going to run some analysis. We're going to talk a lot more about what exactly those computers are doing and end up giving us, I've just said a lot of this, giving up this wonderful outcome. So these are brain signals that this man is using to move around that green cursor. And his task, obviously, is to get the money. And when he does, another money bag appears, and he moves on to the next one. And when if the volume was up, you'd hear a nice little satisfying ka-ching. So he's driving around this green cursor simply by thinking, ostensibly, about how he wants to move it and where he wants it to go. And every time he does it right, he gets another trial. So the first reaction to this, I hope, is to say, that's amazing. This guy's using his brain to steer that thing around. But if you're an engineer or you're in this field, your second reaction might be to say, well, actually, it's not very good. So why, you know, I hate to rain on the parade, but why isn't that better? And so one of the themes of today's talk and of my research in the future, now that this is a viable clinical possibility for people with these kind of deficits, let's try to give them something really valuable, really useful, something that feels as natural and as second nature as you picking up your sandwich at lunchtime. So we do all of this development in non-human primates, rhesus monkeys, and I want to introduce why we use these animals here and then tell you about some of the experiments. So this monkey is manipulating a piece of food just like you were a few hours ago and bringing it into her mouth. And this is a wonderfully dexterous ability that if you watch these monkeys behave, they obviously have a great deal of sensory motor dexterity. And you know, both in terms of their behavior and also evolutionarily speaking, and in terms of their brain organization, these guys are a great model system for developing the kinds of neural engineering, neural prosthetic techniques that we need to use. I just want to tell you about how a neurophysiologist sees the world and just introduce this technique more generally. I won't be talking about all of these things today, but I just want to let you know what's out there. The neurophysiologist really has three main tools in his or her toolbox. The first, they can monitor an animal's behavior and relate that to neural activity. So you put arrays of electrodes into the brain, and you can correlate what those neurons are doing with what the animal is either seeing or doing. Second, you can manipulate neural activity by passing in electrical current, which can drive activity of the neurons, or by inactivating parts of the brain. And by doing that, you can see the relationship in a causal manner between movement and neural activity.
By inactivation, do you mean lesioning or temporary?
Temporary. So we put in a cooling probe or a chemical that eventually diffuses lidocaine or something like that, and you can see what happens when that part's missing. And then the final thing, if you're recording from more than one neuron at a time, you can study the interactions between pairs and groups of neurons. And that's it. That's all a neurophysiologist has got. But with that, we've been able to make great progress in understanding the visual motor system and a lot of other sensory and motor systems in addition to arm movements. It's really a wonderful preparation for this kind of work. So the second aspect of the experimental approach is to put in arrays of electrodes or individual electrodes into the brain. This gives you a sense for the size of the array. And here's a photograph taken during surgery of one of these arrays implanted into the brain of a monkey. So the animal is anesthetized while this procedure is performed. And then for the following 2 or 3 days after the procedure, he's kept on a steady dose of pain meds. Within 2 or 3 days, he's totally back to normal. It's as if nothing ever happened, except now we have one of those little ports that you saw that allows us to monitor activity in his brain while he performs these behaviors. So I'm going to take you through one of the monkey's behaviors, and you can get a sense for the kinds of tasks that these animals are doing, although they're better at it and faster at it than you are, I promise. The trial begins with a square and a cross appearing in front of the animal. For, I think, every experiment I'll show you today, the structure is like this. The animal's been trained over several months to touch the central square and to look at the cross. And I'm sorry if these hieroglyphics are a little confusing, but I hope that they'll get the point. You'll keep seeing them a lot. This is where the monkey is looking, and this is where the animal is touching. Short time later, a cue appears somewhere else in the environment at an unpredictable location. And the monkey's been taught to withhold his movement for a second or two, which is a very difficult thing to get a monkey to do. But eventually they learn it. And then a short time after that, a variable delay period, the central spots are extinguished, and the monkey knows he's allowed to reach to his target. He does that, he gets a reward, a tasty drop of juice, and we go on to the next trial. So in the next experiment that I'm going to show you, and this is still all by way of introduction, this is, none of this research is mine. We'll be getting into my stuff in a few slides. The animal was actually given one of 7 different targets on interleave trials. So here we're going to see what the monkey looks like while he's performing that task. What you see here is a reflective marker that's been taped to his fingertip. This experiment was run in the infrared. So all the monkey is seeing is the fixation cross and the touch points. And you can see him reaching out to those 8 different targets. He's kind of got a nice leisurely pace to it. He works at a high percentage correct, and he'll do thousands of these trials every day. So now, I'm going to take you through a result that was published by other people in Krishna Shenoy's lab in the same issue of Nature where John Donahue's work appeared. And I think you'll agree that performance is better in the monkeys than it is in the human being. Let me quickly explain how, just at very outline level, how the neural prosthetic decoding that you saw in that first video is going to work. What happens is that you have the monkey make many of these reaches that I showed you, and you observe the neural activity across that electrode array while the monkey reaches.
Good question about the array.
Mm-hmm.
How large are those probes compared to neurons? So what are they picking up?
Yeah, at the very tip, they're not much bigger than a neuron. At the tip, they're 3 to 4 times larger than the largest neurons. And we believe that they're picking up the action potential that emerges from the cell body of individual neurons. Now, that may not be entirely true. You may be looking at action potentials within dendritic trees or something like that. But to a first approximation, you're mostly getting individual neurons. And I'm going to have a slide about that in a little bit, which will go into a little more detail than I just did. So we observe this neural activity across the array. And then once we've built up a good understanding of what the neural activity looks like, when we see that pattern of neural activity, we can use it to predict the reach direction. And that's the whole game. I'll go into more detail later on about how this is actually done, but that's the gist of neural prosthetic decoding. So you go through all this with your animal, and you train up your computers to be able to do this for you, and this is the end result that appeared in Nature last summer. Bless you. So you see, what's happening here is that before the monkey can even perform the movement, as soon as he's formed the plan to make the movement, the computer detects what he's going to do and gives him a reward as if he had actually performed it. So the computer has been rigged up to go as fast as possible, and although we enforce a delay period, if this were running without the delay period, it would actually be fast. If the monkey were working without a delay period, this would actually be faster than he can go. So this is a substantial improvement over the Donahue study in some ways, although it was done in monkeys. And these both appeared at the same time in Nature last year.
So the spot shows up, and just by the fact that he wants to go there, he's rewarded, and
yep.
The spot goes away?
Yep. We think, and this is totally anthropomorphizing, we think that he doesn't fully understand what's going on in this task. He thinks he's going to have to reach to it. As soon as he sets up a pattern of activity that's consistent with the arm movement he's about to make, we beat him to the punch, give him a reward as if he'd actually made the reach, and go on to the next target. So these can stream by. He can knock through 2 or 3 of these per second when things are going well.
One is shown, then the monkey thinks it wants to go one, or he didn't think?
So the numbers, I should point out, the numbers are something that were added in the film later. So all the monkey's seeing are those little squares. Yeah, so one appears. He thinks about making that movement. The computer detects that he's made that plan, gives him the reward as if he actually made it, and we go on to the next one.
Based on what you see when he really doesn't reach.
Yeah, exactly.
The criteria by which they're identical as far as data goes.
That's right, that's right.
Sometimes
yeah, within the noise. Yeah.
Sometimes he
does reach. That's because, you know, he says, this is great. I'm getting money for nothing. I'm not even going to bother planning a reach. And then there's no neural signal to interpret. And so he has to actually go ahead and perform that reach to get his reward.
He double guesses himself.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, this is too easy. I'm going to stop participating. I'm not even going to form a reach plan. And then,
when it says reach, the monkey didn't think that it wanted to reach initially.
Right, exactly. He didn't. He got lazy. He didn't bother planning that movement. And then he has to actually perform the movement if he's going to go on.
This is a new sensation for, I mean, nobody has ever had the sensation that the monkey's mind is being read. And
yeah.
It must affect his behavior.
Yeah, it's probably a little scary. it's probably going to be better if we can do this in people who are, eager to, have their minds controlled like this. But I just have to say that this has been before this work was done, it's been true for years that we monitor the movement of eyes, and a lot of neurophysiology, I'll get to you in just one moment, a lot of neurophysiology was done understanding how the eyes move around and rewarding eye movement behavior. And as a result of that, there, you know, thousands of monkeys have gone through the experience of looking somewhere and getting a reward for it. And, ooh, how did they know where I looked? I mean, it's got to be unnerving for them. But they quickly get very used to it, and then it's fun. It's easy for them, and they'll do it for hours. So,
so the reason that this, the results seem to be much, much better than the Donohue results, right? So is the reason because you are actually coupling that with the physical movement of the arm, whereas they just try to elicit some general thought response? Is that the difference?
That is one. There are many differences. And what you've mentioned is definitely going to be a highlight of what I talk about today. Let me say what I think is the most important difference, what I know is the most important difference. What Donohue is trying to do is fundamentally different from what Krishna and Gopal Santhanam and their colleagues have done. So what Donohue is trying to do is estimate point by point where the hand is using brain signals. So as I move my hand, there's a whole trajectory that arguably is encoded by the cerebral cortex. Maybe some of it is shipped downstream to the spinal cord, but they want to try to infer the entire path of the hand. And Krishna is doing an end run around that problem. He just wants to know the end point. So all he's doing, the analogy that we use when we talk about this is a keyboard versus a mouse. So we're just trying to do endpoint decoding. But I'm going to start going back and forth between the two, so it's a good point. And that's the real advantage for the improvement here. The methods are very similar.
Yeah, this should be on the front cover.
I'm going to tell him you said that. We had a beautiful cover shot that's now hanging on the wall in Krishna's Krishna's office, and the guys who did this paper felt doubly rebuked by not making the cover because nature has a policy of not putting human beings on their cover. The only time they put human beings on the cover was Bush versus Kerry in the election, and you know it's every 4 years that you see a human image on the cover. So, darn.
Clarification question: yeah. You said that through some stuff you're going to describe later, you can classify from the probe whether they're going to reach or which of the 7 points are going to reach to.
Yeah. The fullest models tell you not only endpoint but also timing of the movement, and you'll see some activity patterns from individual neurons. We'll look at some actual data, and you can see that it's clearly discriminable to the eye when the monkey is going to make the movement. So you can decode both where and when he's going to reach. And then you, the quantification here involves measurements of accuracy. So, you know, this was done with 7 targets. If we moved up to 16 targets, the accuracy would go way down, and that would affect the bit rate for the analysis and that kind of thing. It's all going to, the eventual device needs to know both of those things for sure.
Well, in this experiment, if the monkey is accurate for, in terms of where it reaches, all you actually have to detect is that it's reaching somewhere, and you can count on the monkey to be reliable about where.
That's right. So the actual algorithm assumes the best on the start of the, on the part of the monkey. It looks over a very specific predefined window. If it gets a signal during that window, it renders a movement. If it, it simulates a movement. If it gets a signal that it can't interpret, then the monkey has to make his own movement. So we're determining where, when here. He tells us where. Yeah.
How do you know where to place the electrodes so you get a clean?
Ah, other people did that work for us. That's 40 years of neurophysiology. You're going to see, I'm going to talk about the actual biological details in a few minutes, but there's functional specialization within the brain. So you can go into different parts of the brain and have a very good guess as to what kind of signal you're going to get out. This is an area, these recordings were done in an area that projects to the spinal cord and projects to the primary motor cortex, so we knew that this would be the right place to harvest this kind of signal. If we wanted to do some other behavior, like, you know, in a human being decoding language or something like that, you'd have to go into a totally different part of the brain. So, but we can rely on years of neuroscience to know how to start. And then once you put in that probe, you don't have to look for individual neurons. You just kind of, there's a very fancy machine that punches it in there for us. And, you know, on the 100 probes, you might get somewhere between 50 and 120 different neurons. And then a certain fraction of those will be actually related to the movement. So it's kind of, we solve the problem with large numbers, basically. All right, let's go on. That's all I want to say by introduction. And I think you guys will agree that neural engineering has really turned a corner over the last few years. And it's, this is, what do you get when you cross a monkey with an array? Okay, it's not just a bad joke. It's actually the driving force behind all of my research. So everything I want to know has to do with what kinds of science is enabled by this technology. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to go through three different experiments and analyses. Arrays have really shifted the balance in neuroscience. It's now fast and not easy, but it's relatively fast and relatively easy to get neuroscience data, which means scientists can spend most of their time analyzing data, mining data, and dreaming up new experiments. It's really closed, it's shortened the development loop in a great way. So I'm going to be able to tell you about a lot of analyses that were done on just a very small amount in terms of time of data. First thing I'm going to tell you about will make more sense in a little while. And it's a basic science discovery. And I'm going to show how that discovery relates to neural prosthetic development. And then I'm going to go into a totally different direction and show you something else that we've done very recently with the arrays. So every talk needs an outline, but outlines are a little bit boring. What I prefer is to make it into a play, to make it into a show. So you've all been to these bizarre kind of one-man shows where one guy plays six different characters, and that's what I'm going to do today. First, I'm going to be a neurophysiologist, and I'm going to make a mess of the brain. Then I'm going to be an engineer, and I'm going to clean it up. And then finally, the neurophysiologist and the engineer are going to work together and try to come up with something good. So this is going to be our outline for the day. So first, some neurophysiology. So I told you about this problem of picking up your sandwich and eating it. And I want to try to use this baseball player to motivate thinking about what your brain has to do when you solve that problem. This guy is about to make a catch. And what's happening, I will argue, is that his brain has to perform a reference frame transformation. He initially gets information about the position of the ball as an image projected onto the back of the eyeball. So it's a flat, two-dimensional representation of the external environment. From that representation, he's eventually going to compute the position of the ball relative to his hand. Okay? Now, in order to get there, a lot of different kinds of information are going to have to come into things. He needs to know where his eyes are in the head. He needs to know where both eyes are and what both of their images of the ball so that he can get its position in three dimensions. He needs to know where the head is on the body. He needs to know where the shoulder, the angles of the shoulder and the elbow and the hand, in order to finally compute where the hand is, where the ball is relative to the hand. Now, for the aficionados in the room, I'll point out that although I've illustrated this as the position of the ball relative to the hand, that doesn't actually have to exist in the brain. It might just be that the brain represents the ball in terms of the joint rotations that would be needed to get the hand to that target. How does that happen? This is a model that first started to appear, as far as I can tell, in the monkey neurophysiology literature in probably the late 80s. And in those papers, they say that this was inspired by robotics, so it has to be right in some sense. And it's true, it does. I mean, this is just a description of the processes that need to take place. And wouldn't it be wonderful if these mapped directly onto the brain? Well, I think that perhaps the last time that neurophysiologists checked in with roboticists was about 20 years ago, because the thinking hasn't evolved too much beyond this kind of sequential model. People have looked for various stages in this process, or they've invented new combinations of this process and tried to map it onto neural signals. There's, of course, another model, which is summarized by this kind of cartoon of a neural network, where all the various signals that I discussed come in, mix in some hidden layer, and you know, in a full representation, it would have recurrent loops and connections within the layer. And then out of this, some complicated processing takes place. There's a bit of magic, and you get commands that can actually drive the muscles to where the hand needs to go. And maybe the actual transformation is buried in very complicated processing in these hidden units. So is there anything we can do to try to decide which of these models of reference frame transformations is actually the right one? I want to just pause for a moment, and those of you who do neurophysiology for a living can tune out for the next 3 minutes. And let me just tell you what I think you need to know to follow the rest of the lecture about neurophysiology. So this is the side view of a monkey brain. You can see its size. It's, I don't know how, it's probably 10 times in volume smaller than ours, less than that. It's less than 10 times smaller. It's probably 5 times smaller. I don't know. It's tiny. It's the size of your fist. The visual processing is back here. This is the central sulcus. And the kind of rule of thumb that's somewhat true is that motor processing happens forward to the central sulcus and sensory processing is behind it. So the area where we record is right here. It's an area called the dorsal premotor cortex. The array goes right there, and this is what we do with it. This is just a schematic drawing of a neuron of an electrode next to an individual neuron. We record a sampled continuous waveform, and on that waveform you can see these occasional deflections, these large voltage fluctuations, and those are the characteristic action potentials that neurons emit. On this particular isolation, there were probably two good neurons that the algorithms can pull out. So that becomes our data set. And we represent the times at which these action potentials occur, and we relate that to the movement that the animal's performing. So here's the task I showed you earlier. The monkey sees a particular stimulus, then after a delay period, he makes a movement to it. And this is what those spikes out of one particular neuron might look like. Low activity early on, accelerating activity when the cue appears, and sustained through the time of the movement. Now neurons, each individual neuron is rather noisy, so if we have the monkey make exactly the same movement a second time, we'll get a different distribution of spike times, although the overall envelope will be the same. We have the monkey make the same movement 8, 10, 20 times, however many he's willing to perform, and we build a histogram of spike times as a function of time through the trial by adding these all together and blurring them out slightly. So this gives us data like this, which we'll be looking at throughout a lot of the rest of the talk. The cue is presented out here. There's no activity before that, then suddenly a burst of activity from this neuron, sustained through the delay period. This is when Krishna and the gang do their decoding. And then there's another little burst of activity at the time of the movement. So neurons are involved in this task, and they're also spatially tuned. This is for a reach to one particular target. It's actually, in this case, it was a reach to a target that was down and to the right. When the monkey reaches to nearby targets, the firing rate is reduced somewhat if the target is nearby, and it's gone entirely if the target is far away. So this is what you need to know about neuroscience, I think, to make it through the rest of the talk. Neurons are involved in this task, and they're spatially tuned.
The coordinate system, is that grid
coordinate? Mm-hmm, yeah, this is a two-dimensional screen in front of the monkey, and it's all relative to where his hand begins.
These are different spikes?
Yeah, so this is what you'd see if the monkey made the reach down and to the right 8 times. And this is what you see when he reaches straight down and added up. So they're at the location of the endpoint of the reach.
The arrangement of the neurons is a retinotopic?
No, it's not. And that's actually what we're going to look at very soon. So neurons near one another don't have any predictable relationship to one another in the experiment I'm about to show you.
Just to clarify, you said the spike times, which I was guessing meant the interval between two successive spikes. So I'm just trying to understand what this representation is, because you talk about firing.
Yeah,
rate.
We don't. You can do. When people do that, they call that spike frequency, instantaneous frequency, and we don't do that. We use time relative to an arbitrary zero. Our zero happens to be the time when the cue is presented. So for each time a neuron spikes relative to the presentation of the cue, is the bin that it's going to be plotted in. So, but they're equivalent. A lot of data is presented that way, and they're really equivalent. We're splatting. Yep. Just sum them along the time dimension, and there you are. Okay. So the coordinate frame task, and I definitely want to let me see how I'm doing and try to get through this a little bit hastily. So it's the same task that you've seen. I've changed the spatial geometry, but don't let that throw you. Now the monkey's going to reach to 10 targets that are arranged in a row above his hand and eye position. And the way that we try to understand whether neurons are more related to the eye position or the hand position is in the following task. We have the monkey perform this reach task with 4 different instructed initial eye and hand positions. So that yellow square that tells him where to start his hand and the purple cross that tells him where to look correspond to these 4 different start positions, and then the monkey makes reaches to these 10 targets. What's important about that is that it allows us to separate the input reference frame eye-centered coordinates from the output reference frame hand-centered coordinates. By simply moving the hand from one side to the other, we can keep targets fixed relative to the eyes, but at different locations relative to the hand. And by moving the eyes from one side to the other, we keep targets fixed relative to the hand, but at different locations relative to the eyes. And that's the whole experimental manipulation that allows us to answer this aspect of the reference frame question for these neurons. So here's what a neuron looks like when you do this experiment. What I'm showing, just like in the last plot, are firing rates for reaches made to these 10 targets. And the location of the histogram that you see corresponds to the location of the target relative to the hand. Okay? So this is what happens when the monkey starts with his hand off to the right-hand side. You can see that there's a response whenever he reaches far to the left in this particular case. In contrast, if the hand moves over here and he reaches to the same 10 targets, I think it's easy to see that the tuning of this neuron has changed in a pronounced manner. So if you look, say, at this location, you can see that the firing rate is quite different because the monkey's performing a very different reach, even though the target's at the same spot on the screen. So this is a neuron that's heavily influenced by the position of the hand. And when we do the dual analysis and move the eyes, you can see that the cell is far less influenced by that. So here's what you already saw. Here's what happens when the eyes move from one side to the other. You can see that the tuning of the neuron changes very little in comparison to the way it changes down here. So to speak about things loosely, we say that this is a neuron that uses limb-centered coordinates to code a reach. We also saw neurons that look like this in this experiment. This is a cell that does the complete opposite. When the eyes move, the cell is heavily influenced. There are certain reaches, say a reach straight up, for which the cell does not respond at all if the eyes are off to the right, but it responds quite a bit when the eyes are off to the left. But when you do the opposite manipulation and move the position of the hand, the cell is almost completely unfazed by that. So this cell will, just to put it in words, will say it uses an eye-centered reference frame.
Is the monkey actually reaching, or are you?
No, in this case, he's actually reaching, yeah. So this represents kind of the ends of a spectrum of neurons that we found in premotor cortex. Some are more eye-centered, while others are more hand-centered. And it would be nice if the story stopped there, but it doesn't. The truth is that most of the neurons lie somewhere in between, and they fit neither of these descriptions all that well. And we need to try to think about that chaos. So I'm going to show you what I mean by that by quantifying the whole population. We did this experiment for 5 days in two animals, and in that time we got about 250 different neurons, and we represented each neuron in the way that I'm about to show you. We simply measure the similarity between this pair of tuning curves and this pair of tuning curves, and we do that simply by imagining that the average activity of the neuron in each of these cases is a point in a 10-dimensional space defined by the 10 different targets. And then we just measure the Euclidean distance between those two points in 10-dimensional space. So you can see that these tuning curves are rather similar. And what that means is that the difference between them is going to be quite low. And the other two curves are different from one another, and the distance between them is high. So for each neuron, that gives us two numbers, and then we simply scatter plot those numbers against one another. One of those values is plotted along the x-axis, and here's actually the better way to think about it. The impact of eye position moves you along this axis, while the impact of hand position moves you along this axis, which means the hand-centered neuron we saw actually plots right here, and the eye-centered neuron plots right here. So here's the story for all the neurons that we found. They're colored black if their position is statistically reliable. We see that there are many neurons that look like that eye-centered neuron that I showed you, and there are many neurons that look like that hand-centered neuron that I showed you. But the vast majority of them actually lie somewhere in between. So this is a choice point. A neurophysiologist faces a real choice here in how exactly you deal with a finding like this, because it would be nice to say, you got some eye-centered neurons, you got some hand-centered neurons, and you got some neurons that I can't really make sense of, but let's not worry about them too much. But as if he predicted this experiment 13 years ago, a very eminent neurophysiologist named Ebb Fetz made this comment about the state of neuroscience at the time. If we ignore all the neurons with complex response properties that we don't understand, we put ourselves in jeopardy of dealing only with idealized and simplistic cases and basically overlooking the truth of what the brain is actually doing. So I, considering myself sufficiently chastened by that voice from the past, I'm not going to simply tell you that here are the important neurons and you can ignore all these. These are bound to have just as much of an involvement in the movement as these other ones, and hopefully we'll eventually be able to have a model that completely accounts for this kind of neural property. And those of you who really want to see what these cells look like, stick around. I've got them in the back of the slides, and you can tell me if you see any regularity here, because we certainly don't. But they're real, and they're contributing to the movement. I predict that if you could do an anatomy study, you would find that these neurons are just as likely to project to the spinal cord as are the neurons that we can more easily interpret. So where are we in terms of the two different models? I had hoped that we would be able to say something about the sequential versus parallel debate and how exactly coordinate frame transformations take place. But if you're really honest with yourself about how the data look, I'm afraid at this point there isn't that much to say. There are some neurons that seem consistent with the sequential model. Those are these suckers that live down here and these suckers that live up here, where we can really ascribe them with confidence to one reference frame or the other. But then there are all these neurons that have a very complicated mixture of different response properties. It's as if they are the hidden layers of a neural network. Yeah.
Well, doesn't it seem like if you have this kind of the hidden layer or parallel representation, that actually would explain the other, the nice clean neurons, because, well, you know, there's just random neurons and some randomly are going to be on one side and some randomly on the other side. So this to me seems like evidence more for the parallel argument.
Yep. I'm coming around to that point of view. A few years ago, I would have looked at this and said, yeah, it's serial. You've got stage A and stage B and maybe a few that don't fit the model. But I'm not going to argue with you because I actually agree with that. Yeah.
Curious. In your graph, you have the open circle, but you also have the light gray square.
Yes. OK. So that's, let me blow it up a little bit. this is just a clip from the paper. I didn't. I think it's good that they're there, and I'm glad you brought this point up. This is the estimate of what zero would be. So I showed you how we have these matched pairs. In one case, the eye moves. In the other case, the hand moves. Well, what we did to compute these gray squares is forget all that and compute the relationship, the distance between a tuning curve and itself, okay, which should be zero. And insofar as it's not zero, that gives us an estimate of our measurement noise. So neurons that overlap with this gray, and this was done, you know, for every single neuron. So neurons that overlap with this gray region are less believable than the ones that do not. So,
how does it get to be non-zero? Different samples with itself?
Yeah, you randomly resample and you do that, you bootstrap, you do it 1,000 times. And neurons are just inherently noisy, and you're going to see that later on. So that's where that comes from. So,
by the way,
yeah.
This comment may not be that little complicated, but to me, these two are not the things that contrast. I think this is simply talking about mathematical structure of the problem, no matter how you do.
Yep.
This is implementation issue.
Yep.
So I don't know if this is A or B question.
Yep.
I think that's
very fair. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, ideally we would have true biologically inspired models for how we think reference frame transformations take place. And then we can do experiments like these to try to choose between those models. And maybe I've given you cartoon models here.
I think in that sense, the one that should be compared with what you call sequential is what roboticists call visual surveying, which is don't go to 3D frame and only work in the 2D world, which I'm pretty sure those players is doing. In other words, they are surveying between what they see with what they even see or they move the hand, rather than computing going through three-dimensional world. That is, in my mind, fairly sure.
Yep.
And implementation of that is, I'm pretty sure here, is either I don't know whether that kind of implementation or not, but somehow this brain connections and that one, at least I was told that's happening here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think we are using, you know, the AND gates or NO gates and
right.
things like, probably not.
Right, right.
So in that yeah. sense, in terms of information computed, I think it's probably more of a two-dimensional visual thing,
mm-hmm.
especially that catching kind of activity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even this one, you know, whether my hand is moving toward the target is probably.
You can do that all in 2D. Yeah.
That's my guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's what should be contrasted.
Mm-hmm.
And then parallel versus the other thing is the little, you should find out the one that should be contrasted with
right.
parallel implementation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a distinction to be made between, to just reiterate what you're saying, the algorithms that the brain is implementing versus the actual implementation
wow.
can be quite different. Yeah, we want to make sure that we're, you know, testing models at the appropriate level. And yeah, an idea like a two-dimensional, doing the whole thing in a two-dimensional space and trying to minimize your error between the hand and the target is certainly. Something that sounds a lot like the servo model you're proposing. And people have explored that kind of possibility more in the ocular motor domain. But yeah, so this is exactly the kind of conversation that I want to be having. So yeah, let's go on. Let's take this up later
yeah.
and let's go on. All right. Let's, you know, given for a moment that there may be a real implementation difference in a sequential versus parallel model, maybe there's something that we can do to try to rescue this data set and try to choose between them. And I'm about to describe a project, a data analysis project on these data that's going to be done by Craig Lahocki, a bioengineering undergraduate at Pitt. And what Craig is going to look into is the correlations between pairs of neurons. So I described correlations early on as a way of understanding network architecture. So Craig's going to ask the question, let me look for correlations across the whole population of 250 neurons, although you can't do that because they weren't all simultaneous. About 100 were collected simultaneously. And look to see what, if the correlation structure gives you any sense for the network that's implementing this. Maybe what happens is that neurons that use a similar reference frame communicate with one another, but only rarely communicate with neurons that participate in the other reference frame or constitute the other reference frame. And that might be taken as evidence for a sequential processing model.
Can you explain this representation? I don't think
yeah.
we get too far there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm using just a little line to indicate that two neurons are correlated. So this is really just a on the plane ride over mock-up of what this project is going to be all about. But to tell it in more detail, Craig's going to take a battery of neurons that were recorded simultaneously, blind himself to what reference frame they were in, look for correlations, and then once he's found a correlated pair, go find out what reference frame they were in. And then if they were in the same reference frame, if they use the same reference frame, that would be indicated by a little line like this. And if they used a different reference frame, would connect those points with a line like
this.
Sorry,
the X and Y axes positions or correlations?
The X and Y axes, I should have kept all my labels on here. This is the scatter plot that we use to ascribe a reference frame. So neurons below the main diagonal, this is, I mean this to be exactly this plot. So neurons below the diagonal are the eye-centered neurons, and neurons above the diagonal are the hand-centered neurons. So Craig's question is, do the eye-centered neurons tend to be correlated with one another, or are the correlations pretty much evenly dispersed among the population, which would be evidence for a parallel model? So this is going to be a very interesting correlation structure, and whether or not it really allows us to decide between these two models is something that we're going to have to think long and hard about, but it's going to give us some clues for sure. So conclusion of part one of this talk. When you go into the brain, things are messy, and don't listen to anyone who tells you they're not. Part two, one thing that we know for sure is that the position of the eyes matters, okay? So if I'm going to make a reach, suppose I make the same reach twice in a row, but in one case I'm looking to the right-hand side, there will be a pattern of activity that's set up in my premotor cortex that's consistent with driving my hand to the target. But suppose I make the same reach with my eyes pointed off to the left-hand side. there's a totally different pattern of neural activity that's responsible for driving that movement. Somehow, they're equivalent in terms of the end result, but they're totally different states in the brain. So we want to try to understand how that harms a neural prosthetic decoder. Most people who do neural prosthetics don't bother monitoring eye position, because the understanding before these experiments and other very similar ones was that eye position didn't matter when you went this far into the motor system. But I think it's doubtless at this point that they really do matter. So how can an engineer exploit this fact of the brain in order to build a better neural prosthetic decoder? And that's what we're going to be getting into in the second part of this talk. So back to this video, you've seen it before. And I am sensitive to the time, so I'm going to try to go quickly through these next two stories. So this is the video that we saw, and as I told you guys, first you just all got to sit back and say, wow, that's really cool. Just fantastic. But, you know, like I said, let's try to do better and try to understand why not. So the first thing that people say when they see this video is, well, clearly there aren't enough neurons. If we got more neurons, we'd be able to do even better. The second thing that people say is, yeah, well, you don't have the right decoding algorithms. If you really understood how to extract signals from this brain area, you'd be able to smooth these movements out and get them on track a lot better. But what I believe is that if we had a better understanding of what the neurons were really doing and what kinds of information they really cared about in the environment, then we'd be able to do much better that way. So I want to try to pursue point three as much as I can, and that's going to go on in the second part of this talk. So, since eye position matters in PMD, very simply put, decoding should incorporate eye position, and then things will improve. And I think you'll probably all agree at this point that that's doubtless true, but let me just quickly go through it. For those of you who have never encountered this concept of neural prosthetic decoding before, let me try to quickly explain it in this slide. We record from, in this case, 91 individual neurons simultaneously. We have the monkey make reaches to 10 different targets, and we learn a vector of neural activity, 91 element vector that corresponds with a reach to each of the 10 targets. And that's done with very standard methods, fitting Poisson models to the neural population. And we learn these lambda parameters for each combination of cell and target. So we end up with 910 parameters in this model. And we use that during the testing phase to estimate the target location from the vector of neural activity. We just ask for the observed vector of neural activity, which target makes that vector most likely. And that's our estimate of where the monkey planned to reach. Now, the way that this is actually trained and tested is we have several hundred trials like this. We take each trial, we take it out, we train the model using all the other trials, and then we test on the trial that we left out. So that's called leave one out cross-validation, and it allows us to not contaminate our test data with training data. Now, I want to go through, we built and tested neural prosthetic decoders in three separate modes. The first mode is the same one that everyone else does. We ignored eye position entirely, a la Donahue, a la a lot of other people who do this kind of work. In the second mode, we tracked eye position and built that into the model, and things will improve when we do that. And the third mode is kind of a neat little trick. Instead of actually tracking eye position, what we did was to try to estimate eye position from the neural activity. So I'll have more to say about that later on. Let's go into this first mode and just look at how the decoder performs. So there are 10 targets. They're rather close together. They're not well spaced the way they were in the video that I showed you earlier, and that's going to harm decode performance, but so what? So now, suppose the monkey wants to reach to this target in the upper left location. We represent, and say he does this dozens of times across the day, we represent the estimate of the endpoint as a location in this grid. So if the decoder did perfectly, this little spot would be black, the upper left corner would be black, and every other spot would be white. But as you can see, the decoder mostly gets it right, but makes some errors. And when we do that for all the targets, you can see that the decoder roughly gets it right when he reaches down into the right. It's usually right, but it's sometimes slightly off. And this is a more traditional way of plotting this in a confusion matrix. If this is the actual target, than what was your estimated target. And you can see that there's a smear there. So it's decent, you know, 45% correct, not great, but certainly good enough to drive a device. Now, if we switch into an operating mode where we train and test with the eyes fixed at a consistent location, which is different from what's done in the human studies and most other neural prosthetic decoding, you can see that things tighten up a lot. You do a lot better at estimating endpoints if you both train and test with the eyes at a consistent location. So this just takes this intuition from the physiology that eye position matters, and it applies it to an engineering context to show that by using this information that we have about the neurons, we can actually do better in a decoding context. So that's cool. What that means is if you have an array in a human brain, you might want to give the patient a pair of eye tracking goggles. These are commercially available. They're pretty lightweight, almost stylish. You can wear these things, and they have little cameras built into the sides that can track the position of the person's eye. If a patient were to wear a device like that, you can see that their decode performance would clean up immediately as long as you built that as a parameter into the training and the testing. But maybe we can do better. Since these neurons are modulated by the position of the eyes, maybe we can actually infer the position of the eyes from the neural activity itself. So now we have this third operating mode where what we actually do is train the model on both target location and eye position, and then we ask the model to report back both those things, target location and eye position. And here's how it does. It's doing, I forget the exact number, I think it's doing about 45% overall, but keep in mind that it's solving a much harder problem because it now has to tell you both the target location and also the start configuration. And you can see that even if it blows it on the start configuration, it gets it roughly right on the target location because there's power along most of these most of the energy is along these diagonal bands. So this is just kind of a conceptual idea at this point. But it might be a way to more intelligently leverage what we know about the brain in order to do decoding. So I think that's just a summary of this. Yeah, so I'm just summarizing what we know here. You're going to do better with your neural prosthetic decoding if you monitor eye position. But you might even be able to not monitor eye position and use the brain to tell you where the eyes are pointed. So I just want to talk about another data analysis project that's going to be going on in the lab. This is going to be done by Narayan Krishnamurthy, who's an electrical engineering graduate student who's working in the lab. And he's going to look at trajectory decoding. So everything that I've told you about is endpoint decoding. What Narayan's going to do, this is a little cartoon drawing of what one of the patients was doing in the Donahue study. The hand is kind of meandering on it. The cursor that represents hand position was kind of meandering to the target. But we know that the patient was looking wherever he wanted. He was probably tracking that green cursor with his eyes. So Narayan is going to explore, if you keep the eyes fixed, does the trajectory decoding clean up? So that's what he's working on. And I have a hunch it's going to work out well, but you don't know until you actually see it. So we shall see. Stay tuned. Third story, and I see it's 4:30. So this is rather independent from the first two, and I'm certainly happy to tell anyone who wants to hear about it all about it. Let me just, it's...
How long is it?
It's going to be, it'll be 5 minutes probably. Yeah, let me, okay. Look, you're a valiant audience, let's forge on. Okay, so what do you get when you cross a monkey with an array? You get very stable long-term recordings, which is a total novelty in neurophysiology. Okay, what people usually do, you get a window of 2 or 3 hours where your monkey is really willing to work, and during that time you hope to get as many neurons as you can, at least in the old way of doing experiments. But now with this technology, you can keep neurons for many, many hours, and you can really go to a deeper level of characterizing their properties. And one very simple question you can ask is, how stable are neurons? Do they have consistent properties across several hours? That's precisely the question that we wanted to ask. And it seems like a no-brainer. A neuron should keep doing what it's doing. But there were a couple of reports that have been published over the last few years that suggest that actually neurons change their properties over the course of hours and minutes. And we wanted to really explore whether that was true. So we call this the neurons are like hair hypothesis. I mean, you wake up in the morning, you take a shower, you comb your hair, and the vector in which any particular strand of hair points is totally arbitrary. But together, your hair covers your whole head, unless you're like me. But so there's a this idea that maybe individual neurons can do a fairly arbitrary thing, but together they collectively get the job done. And they can change what they're doing over time in a fairly unconstrained way. And we wouldn't have really thought that was true, except for this paper that came out a few years ago in 2005 that suggested that neural properties are variable. And I kind of want to skip over the detail. I just want to point out that this is their visual representation of that variability. And some people in the audience are going to know this paper pretty well. So this is suggesting that, I'll just tell you what they've plotted here. This is the contribution of the neurons to a decode over time. And what they found, this is work by Miguel Nicolelis and his colleagues, they found that there are many neurons that make a stable contribution to a neural prosthetic decoder, but there are many more neurons that have a variable contribution. Sometimes they matter a lot for the decoder, and sometimes they matter far less for the decoder. So this is really exciting if it's true, because, and this is just my note to say that there are other people who are presenting similar data these days with these long-term recordings. This is really important if it's true, because it means that when a basic neurophysiologist has characterized some sensory property in the brain, a tuning curve or something like that, there's nothing to say that if he repeated those measurements half an hour later, an hour later, a day later, he wouldn't get something totally different from the same neurons. It's not that all that, you know, 40-year history of work is wrong so much as it's very time dependent. It's just what that neuron was doing that day, you know, before the wind blew and changed the orientation of the hair. It also has huge implications for neural prosthetics work, because it means that you either have to have a very sophisticated decoding algorithm that knows these neurons are going to have an arbitrary relationship, or you've got to bring a patient back into the clinic every couple of days or a couple of hours in order to retrain the entire decoding algorithm. So this is really important if it's true. We were sitting on data exactly like Nicolelis and colleagues had collected, and we just wanted to repeat their analyses and see if we could corroborate what they found. So credit to Cindy Chestek, a really great graduate student in Krishna's lab, who's done all of the heavy lifting on this project. And what we decided to do was to analyze the relationship between neural activity and behavior in three different ways, simply looking at firing rate and tuning of the neurons, and then repeating the Nicolelis analysis and looking at the contribution to a neural prosthetic decoder. That's what's on the next few slides. We took a data set where the monkeys performing these center outreaches for thousands of trials. And there's one superstar monkey in the lab that worked for 6 hours and gave us 12,000 trials. And we thought this would be the killer data set. If we're going to see variability over time, it's going to be in this very long data set. So first thing, let's look at firing rate as a function of time. These are repeated reaches to the same target. And you can see for this particular case, it's very stable and it's not significantly different from a slope of zero. When we quantify it, we find that the vast majority of neurons have almost no change in firing rate over time across two animals onto preferred direction. This is the preferred direction of one of these neurons. The squares are the measured values averaged over many repetitions. And the dashed line is a cosine fit to these data. The blue is the first half of trials for the day, and the magenta is the second half. And these little circles represent the inferred preferred direction from the cosine fit. And you can see these are two of the examples that show the most change in preferred direction over time. And they also show the greatest firing rate change. So this is an example where firing rate changes, preferred direction changes, but arguably not by very much. And when we plot a histogram of the preferred direction changes, we find that they're rather small, very few are significant, and very few exceed a bootstrap estimate for what you'd expect by chance in your measurement noise. And then finally, the third technique, really comparing apples to apples with the Nicolelis study. What they did, they would agree with us on this part, that the neural ensemble as a whole does a very good job of estimating hand position. I'm showing the horizontal position of the hand is a function of time in red, and the linear model that estimates hand position in blue. And you can see that very soon after training the model and very late after training the model, decoding performance is about the same. Maybe it's starting to get a little bit worse as the day goes on. So they agree with us on this. The models stay stable across the entire population. But we also find that individual neurons stay stable, and this is where they found something rather different. They found that individual neurons might do a very good job early on, but that same neuron later in the day will not be predicting movements very well. That's not at all what we found. And when we represent our data in the same way they did, we find this rock-solid stability. And just to compare a few slides ago, it's very different from what they found. And in particular, they found a lot of variability within premotor cortex. They also recorded in a few other brain areas, and all of our recordings were in this area. So we feel like we've done a community service project. We've shown that the world is safe for both neurophysiologists and also engineers. Measurements that neurophysiologists make on day one are very likely to be the same on day two, unless you have an explicit pressure on the system to change. And similarly, in an engineering context, if you train up Mr. Jones's decoder on Monday, he doesn't need to come back into the clinic on Tuesday to get everything retrained. So we think that this is just a real relief, and you know, everything's safe. You can move forward and do your experiments. So why the differences? I'm not really going to go into them now, but you know, they could be as trivial as slightly different brain areas or cortical layers or something like that. They could be differences in the tasks that the animals were performing, and other explanations like that. That actually we're talking with Jose, the first author on the study, to try to come to some reconciliation. So that gives you a taste for the kinds of things that are enabled by having chronic arrays implanted in a monkey brain, and how physiology and engineering can really dovetail with one another in this kind of research. So like any good story, you need a moral. Premotor cortex encodes reach goals in a very complex way, including an influence of the position of the eyes. And people doing neural engineering it would behoove them to take that into account when they do their decoding. And that's just, I think that's going to be a story that continues in the future. The more we learn about what the brain does, the more we can leverage that into improved neural prostheses. And then, you know, this nice little add-on story that was enabled by the array that shows that the relationship between neural activity and behavior is stable, despite reports to the contrary. So let me just thank the people who have made this work possible. There's Krishna Shenoy, who's been an excellent postdoc mentor to me. Cindy, who was my direct collaborator for the final project, and then these fellows who were my collaborators for the first two projects. And then thank you guys all for sticking it out this long. I appreciate it. Ideas, questions, yeah.
One of the things I found striking that's quite obvious to you, is that if I understand correctly, all 100 or however many probes and neurons participate in the hand end of the eyes. I mean,
yeah.
They're all doing something other than inactive. So what
yeah.
I understand is that whatever the representation is in this area,
And it might even predict something that's befuddled physiologists for years, which is if you have the animal do exactly the same behavior over time, twice in a row you're going to get a totally different distribution of spike times. Is that meaningful, or is that just, is it that neurons can't do better, or is it that those neurons are doing something totally different simultaneously that's also modulating that activity? And so, yeah, whether or not how independent the representations are in the brain is something that is very much a big topic for us. We know, you know, this is a very small chunk of tissue, so it's not terribly surprising that there could be one tiny chunk of tissue devoted to this very important, you know, for the monkey, this is all he's doing at the moment, like you suggested. You know, if you record somewhere else in the brain while the animal's doing the same thing, you'll see signals that bear no relationship to it and show a huge amount of variability. So, yeah, that's some of what I don't know if that gets at it directly, but that's some of the content of the answer.
Yeah. How long does that last? The monkey lives and then electrode works for how many days?
Yeah. So the big scary looming thing is that perfecting these algorithms is not going to be what makes these devices clinically viable. There are patients clamoring to get a device that works just as well as the one that that fellow I showed at the outset has. The thing that doesn't make these devices viable is the fact that the arrays only last for about 6 months. You can't do a major neurosurgery every 6 months. So, you know, we can come up with state-of-the-art algorithms and argue with our colleagues about what's best, but none of it matters until we can make the arrays last. You know, people want a lifetime of 4 to 10 years before you can really start advertising this as something that is worth the surgical complications. So our best arrays last 8 months to 14 months, but not longer.
Yeah. What's the reason? The materials are wrong?
You know, we thought we knew. The brain begins to reject this thing almost automatically. There are glial cells in the brain that basically, like your body would form scar tissue, the brain can do the same thing. So when you take these arrays out, instead of, you find that all the tips are enshrouded in this white gunk that doesn't conduct electrical signals at all. So there's gliosis that's set in. We learned something very interesting over the past couple of months, which is that there's one array that survived for over 2 years, but it was put into an animal that is either stubborn or not intelligent, doesn't do the behavior. So either she's a lot smarter than us or a lot dumber than us because she's refusing to participate in these experiments. Let's hope not. The array was put in, she was trained, nothing ever happened, so she sat in her cage, and you know, the bitter irony is that her array is still good 2 years later. But it certainly crossed our minds that maybe there's something about hooking up to the recording device every year. Maybe it's not the brain that's the problem. Maybe the connections go bad. You know, maybe inadvertently a little current is passed every time you attach the probe, and that's ruining the tips. So eventually that array will be taken out, and another one will be put in, and we'll see if it's been covered with glia in the same way. But it's array lifetimes. It's really the bottom line in neural prosthetics.
Has the work been done that looks at which muscles are
No, that's exactly what a neurophysiologist should be doing. That's I try to understand connections between neurons within the brain, but the real task is to understand connections from the brain to the muscles. And you know, it's kind of funny that that's what actually was done first in this field 30, 35 years ago when the field was born. People said, well, you can't record from neurons unless you know whether they project to the spinal cord into the muscles. So every recording that was done would be done on identified output neurons. And for reasons of expediency more than anything else, people stopped doing that. And it's been a setback for us.
Many of these neurons are not talking to individual muscles at all. They're going through separate.
Right, systems. Right. There will be a small group of neurons that project directly to the muscles, or rather to the neurons that innervate the muscles, and those are for the hand movements. Which,
do you know where yours are going?
No. We know from separate anatomy experiments, not in these actual animals, but from separate studies, that close to 50% of them will either go to the motor cortex and then to the spinal cord, or some will go directly to interneurons in the spinal cord itself. But we haven't identified the outputs for any of these neurons.
So is there evidence this is a supervisory role? Or
is yeah, that's the question that we all either ask or try to come up with a good reason to not ask all the time. And the way that we phrase it is, does this brain area code movements or does it code muscles? Does it code joints or does it code something more abstract than that? And people will swear by their stance on that issue without very much data to back them up. So it's just, I mean, that is the $64 question in this field, and we just don't know, but would love to. So
I was told that picking up the surface signal rather than going, instead of going into deep, is reasonably good enough.
Yep, it is.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Mm. The Donahue video, you could get something just as good with surface recordings. And surface recordings are nice because you don't have to go into the brain, and they don't wear out. You just, you know. So that's really the threshold for us. If we can't do better than surface recordings, we might as well not even bother. So I think that in the future, this field will do better. So one clear advance that this technique has is the guy who is doing this, he can talk while he's doing this. He doesn't need to be fully mentally engaged. But the surface recordings sample from the entire skull in order to get a reasonable signal, which means that different parts of the brain that have different functional specializations, if they do something else, you're a goner. You're going to get a different pattern of activity. So if you're watching TV while you're trying to control your robot arm, the different visual images are going to set up a different distribution of activity on these electrodes, and there goes your decoding. If you, you know, make the mistake of thinking about something different, if your mind wanders, you're not going to get good decoding anymore. So this at least, right, it's not better decoding, but it's less cognitively demanding right now. And also, each time you put on the helmet of electrodes, they're slightly shifted, so the patient's going to need to go through the effort of relearning the new relationship between the neural activity and the movement. But this is always fixed.
But not necessarily from above, outside the skull, but inside the skull.
Oh, yes.
Go inside.
Yeah. That's a good intermediary between this and that, but that has all the drawbacks of this approach. Those electrodes may last a little bit longer, and you have far fewer of them, but that's another way that people have gotten good control. Our hope really is that you'll be able to get very precise control out of this. There are people in Andy Schwartz's lab that are studying, trying to use these signals for grasping. And to get that kind of multidimensional control is just never going to happen with electrocorticograms like that. You know, this is just a proof of concept at this stage, but we really think that the frontier lies in getting a lot more information directly from the neurons than from these aggregate measures. Yeah.
Talking again about the surface recording idea, why could you not somehow learn what's the distracting stuff so that you could figure out to ignore those signals because they don't matter for the time?
Yeah. Well, if you put it, if you put the electrodes in the right place, then you make the job of ignoring extraneous stuff a lot easier because it just doesn't drive those neurons. So, you know. All of these devices, Andy Schwartz has shown, other people have shown that even animals who don't really fully cognitively understand what they're doing, they learn to drive the neurons in different ways to make them better suited for the decoding. So the brain does some of the learning, the models can do some of the learning, and you know, everyone right now goes into motor cortex, but maybe what we should be doing is going into prefrontal cortex, which is the heart of learning and arbitrary associations, and just allow the patient to discover on his own what the mapping is between neural activity and behavior. And that's an area that has a lot of cognitive access and a lot of plasticity, and it might be that the technology that really works in patients goes into those neurons where you don't have any of these confounds and can learn it. Yeah. Yeah.
The second time you played the video of the guy, I noticed that his head was moving around.
Yeah.
You didn't say whether the monkey's heads are immobilized in the experiment.
That's right. Thank you. I noticed that I didn't say it, and I'm glad you brought it up. The monkey's heads are immobilized.
Right.
So
I was wondering whether the fact that his head is moving, combined with mm-hmm. what you just explained to us about the eye position,
absolutely,
might explain why what he's doing is so much less efficient
absolutely.
Than saccadic movements.
Absolutely. In my experiment, the only parameters that I manipulated, just because I wanted to keep things clean and simple, were hand position and eye position. But in related studies, not involving reaching, people have moved the head around and shown the modulation that has. And there's two kinds of modulation. There's vestibular and otolith, and you can separate those influences. Just about any postural signal you can, you know, I've become not quite cynical. I've become realistic. Any signal you can think of is going to modulate these neurons. And the more of that you can account for, the more of that you can restrict, I think the better you'll do. I think the real answer is to do a very long very long training session for the decoder, where the person performs a lot of movements, a lot of head movements and a lot of eye movements, so you really explore the space of possibilities, because they're all distinguishable in this cortical tissue, so that when the brain is confronted with that distribution later, it knows, oh, this is that funny state where he's looking up into the left, but he wants to reach down into the right. As long as you experience that during training, then your decoder can detect it for you during testing. So you're right that all these things are going to be modulating those neurons.
Doesn't it take babies months to learn that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what happens when you sever the monkey dies?
you know.
Use the force.
I'm glad you asked that. I'm really glad you asked that. And since you guys are still here, I just want to tell you what happens when you cover the monkey's eyes. So my first goal in the lab is to reproduce Krishna's videos, but make them more boring than they are. I want when that video is running that you don't see anything, okay? So I want the monkey to be able to be presented with an array of stimuli, and then that array goes away, and the monkey knows that he has to hit those stimuli in order. But I don't want to give him any visual feedback about how he's doing. Instead, I want to micro-stimulate in the brain to deliver faster, hopefully more accurate, not more accurate, but a faster representation of how his of the motor plan that he's set up. So the goal that I hope we can get to within a couple of years is to cover the monkey's eyes and have him do this entirely in the dark, using micro-stimulation as his feedback signal about whether he did it correctly or not. And just, you know, my hope is that if an animal has an apparatus like that set up, that that's going to tighten the feedback loop in such a way that the thing begins to feel like it's really an extension of him, kind of the way that your car feels embodied after you drive it around for a while.
There's a method of learning to play the piano where you practice in the dark.
Oh, really?
To avoid any visual distractions.
And, you know, back when people touch typed and, you know, whiteout was expensive and slow, I mean, expensive to use and slow, people really trained. I took classes in how to type while I was reading over here. So, yeah, we want to do touch typing in a neural prosthetic context. Because then how great to not have the visual system tied up, you know, with calibrating this. You can do whatever you want with your eyes. Just like a natural movement. Your hand can just do the thing. You check where the target is, and then it doesn't matter whether you're looking at it, you can still grab
can
it.
Can you feed in the interpretation to, if I have a perfect computer vision system?
Yes. Yes.
And then yes. Feed it to the
yes.
brain and
yes.
There's a beautiful girl.
Yes. Yes. That'll be, when we can develop that kind of technology, you know, when I can basically take my iPod and put it in my brain, we'll be very happy. So to be a little less facetious about it, Doug Weber, who's also at Pitt, is working on writing in somatosensory signals and proprioceptive signals for exactly this kind of thing. Doug Weber, yeah. And the other thing is there's a whole emphasis in neural prosthetics to develop devices for the blind that would basically, you have a camera hooked up to a pair of glasses, and you micro-stimulate in the visual cortex in order to render the visual scene. And, you know, that's in very rudimentary stages as well, but the hope is that that'll work out soon.
I'd like to ride into a much higher level.
Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't ask. What exactly would you like to write in? I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could give people seriously though? I mean, this is the memories. Wouldn't it be great if we all had a 60 gigabyte picture perfect memory? Yeah. I really think that you know, looking forward and getting a little science fiction-y, motor control is just the first problem that we're going to solve with this kind of reading out and writing into the brain, that there are just many more and vastly more important problems. I mean, you know, neuropsychopharmacology has really taken off, and I don't see why this can't have an even greater horizon. And then the potential, everyone talks about tailoring medications to individual human beings based on their genetic code, but we'll be able to tailor microstimulation to individual people based on MRI scans of what exactly is wrong. Say with a with someone with a depression, there are different brain substrates for different kinds of depression, and we might be able to stimulate or inhibit appropriate areas in a very individual way.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thank you.